been a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
I really didn't believe what the heck that could be.
Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they
stayed
directly
spot
both times. They're
outdoors,
like I say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. Mark, Richard, are you ready for this?
My cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc.
UFOs over New York, and I ain't too surprised.
For
the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello, and welcome to program 432 of Strange Days Indeed. On the cast this week, our British correspondent Stuart Miller, Leslie Kane. You must know Leslie Kane. If you don't, you will very shortly. An amazing woman who has been looking into the whole schmozzle that's been happening in Phoenix, Arizona for the last 10 years. And also into the Kecksburg mystery. She's one of the founders of the Coalition for Freedom of Information. And they have been in court this past week with NASA. NASA having some difficulty in releasing paperwork under the Freedom of Information Act that pertains to the Kecksburg crash back in the 60s. We'll get into that with Leslie, as well as what's been going on in Phoenix, Arizona. And then we shall head to Roswell, New Mexico. Dennis Balthaser lives there, a UFO researcher. He'll discuss his work. Interestingly enough, the Great Pyramid of Giza, Roswell, and the upcoming UFO festival. It's the 60th anniversary of the alleged crash outside Roswell, New Mexico. And we'll also talk about Aztec. Apparently there was another crash there in Aztec, New Mexico. All of that coming up shortly. And of course, Strange Days Indeed. It wouldn't be Strange Days Indeed without our weekly contributing editor, Dave Furlott, and his take on it. But first, I want to mention Wendy Connors. I want to mention the fact, and we will do it more than once in this program, the retirement of Wendy Connors. Wendy Connors of Faded Discs. Wendy has retired before, but she sounds as if she may mean it this time. Although Wendy has promised that when she's feeling better, she will join us here on Strange Days Indeed. But first of all, listen to this.
If you had been here 10 years ago and standing out here and looking up there at the lights and the view, you would have been astounded. You would have been amazed. The lights were really brilliant, and it was just fascinating. It was enormous. It just felt otherworldly. You know, in your gut, you could just tell it was otherworldly. And I suspect that unless the Defense Department proves us otherwise, that it was probably some form of an alien spacecraft. I think as a public figure, you have to be very careful about what you say, because people can have pretty emotional reactions, and my goal wasn't to try to stir the pot. I still, behind the scenes, tried to investigate it, but I got nowhere.
I could dig it, baby. I just want to see.
That's the voice of former governor of Arizona, Fife Symington. Why did I play that? Well, because that's what he had to say on CNN's Anderson Cooper 360 on Thursday of this past week. This is after holding a press conference immediately after the March 13th sightings in Phoenix, Arizona, and having his aide come out in a stupid alien costume and really making a mockery of all of those hundreds of witnesses who saw boomerang or chevron-shaped objects down there in Phoenix. We'll talk more about that with probably everybody on the program this week.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Berloff.
There was recently a post on the UFO updates list called UFOs in 300. And although the poster was basically on a different tangent, the post got me thinking. Yeah, I know, a very, very dangerous thing. I've recently had the privilege of seeing 300, compliments of my older son, who thought it would be a fun get-together for him, me, and his younger brother. But that wasn't the only reason he wanted to take me to see the movie. They both have developed an interest in history, and knowing of my love of military history, both of them wanted to pick my brain about the historical accuracy of the movie. But how can 300 have anything to do with ufology? Two things that have absolutely no bearing on the other, or even a reference to each other, cannot be compared, you might say. Well, to make my point, I'm going to have to give you a little bit of a background. The Battle of Thermopylae occurred in August of 480 BC between Persia and the Greek city-states. It was a last-stand affair that would make Custer's battle look like a picnic on the American plains. The historical accounts of the battle argue about only one thing, the numbers of the Persian army. The low numbers place the army of King Xerxes at 250,000, and the high numbers place it closer to 2 million troops. Against this overwhelming force, the Greek city-states marshaled a total of 7,100 men to defend their homeland. Now, the movie 300 is based somewhat loosely on this heroic stand, but additionally, the movie is actually based completely on a graphic novel by Frank Miller. It's something that, in my day, we would have called a comic book. Now, the movie is extremely accurate at depicting the graphic novel, much more so than depicting the actual event of the battle. And this is where it ties into ufology for me. I believe ufology is huge. Within the study of UFOs, there is so much that hasn't even been examined or investigated that it could tie people up for decades just trying to get to the truth. We have trace evidence, photographs, motion footage. We have tens of thousands of reports from witnesses with impeccable credentials. We have some historical cases that have reached some incredible factual conclusions, like Roswell. Fact, the U.S. Air Force admits that the United States Army Air Force lied when they said it was just a weather balloon. But yet, for some, all this is not enough. Either it's not scary enough or it's not exciting enough. Some people have to add to it. They have to try and make it bigger than life. They have to enhance it for whatever reason. I suspect enhance it for the same reason that 300 enhances the Battle of Thermopylae, to make money by appealing to a wider audience. Frank Miller didn't think the Battle of Thermopylae was enough. He added incredible creatures to the battle, such as war rhinos, disfigured giant champions, a Persian royal court of amputees, disfigured lesbians, and creatures that seemed to come from another world. Through his graphic creation, he managed to actually turn a historical elite Persian military force into a bunch of samurai sword-wielding ninjas. And then, there are those within ufology that don't think we have enough. They add alien and government conspiracy, create stories of a multitude of good, evil, and benign races of aliens, toss in stories of back-engineered technology and corporate and alien conspiracy that seem bent on keeping Earth on a self-destructive course. I think the Battle of Thermopylae as a historical event is more than large enough by itself to maintain the glory of the heroic stand by a valiant few against a multitude of invaders. And I also think ufology by itself is large enough that we don't have to generate incredible theories to make it more exciting. All the things added to the Battle of Thermopylae by the movie 300 and all the things added to ufology by exopolitics just hide the reality from us. It makes me think about one correct historical quote in the movie 300. A Persian emissary says, "The 1,000 nations of Persia descends upon you. Our arrows will blot out the sun." Ufology is being blotted out by the arrows of exopolitics, and it would appear that some of us are going to have to do as the Spartan officer told the Persian emissary. Then we will fight in the shade. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
Good one, Dave. not getting good reviews, either the 300 or Exopolitics.
Well, actually, it's sort of a half and half with the 300, but their reviews by far are much better than Exopolitics ever would be in my interpretation.
It was a weird tie-in for me, the 300 and UFOs.
Well, what can I say? It's one of those things, like I said, you take a huge thing by itself, and then, that's not interesting enough. Let's add this to it. Let's add that to it. Oh, let's bring this into it. Bottom line, you turn it into a comic book. Well, that's the same thing that Exopolitics is doing to ufology. It's not interesting enough. Let's add this. Let's add that. Let's add this little theory. Let's add this little theory.
And bring in a former Canadian defense minister.
Yes,
just
exactly.
For good measure.
Exactly. And let's feed him just the stuff that substantiates our position. Let's not show him any of the other stuff that's already out there and that's interesting enough all by itself.
Mm.
You know, it irks me. The position that Mr. Hellyer was in back in those days, he had access to all of the information, any UFO sightings, anywhere within the military or government organization. Why doesn't he take a look at some of that stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Why not take a very serious, hard look at some of those cases when he was in power?
Well, he was too busy deconstructing the Canadian Armed Forces.
That's true, too. Yes.
I don't know that deconstructing is the right word, but combining or unifying.
Yes, yes, the infamous unification.
Yes.
Yeah, let's have everybody in the same uniform and yada, yada, yada.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that didn't quite work out the way it was supposed to.
Well, enough of Exopolitics and Paul Hellyer, I guess, for the time being, huh?
Oh, yes. I hope they wither.
I have my doubts, actually. There are too many people involved with too much riding on it all, you know?
Well, as one of the Spartans said to the other Spartan, let's hide under the shield while the arrows fall.
The slings and arrows of outrageous fortune beset us all. And that pretty much sums it up, doesn't it?
It's true.
It's true. Thank you, Dave, for a lot.
Thank you.
Hey, we'll talk to you next week.
For sure.
Good one. Bye.
Bye-bye.
A regular contributor to this program is our British correspondent, Stuart Miller. He's the publisher of UFO Review, which you can take a look at any time online at uforeview.net. A sunny but really cold day in Toronto at the moment, Stuart Miller. Hello from sunny but really cold Canada.
And hello from sunny but really cold Manchester in the UK, Arlie. It's exactly the same here. I would like, if I may, to take this opportunity to pay tribute to a young lady who has made an immense contribution to ufology and recently, in the last couple of days, just announced that she was stepping down, and that's Wendy Connors, a regular contributor to this program.
Yes.
It is hard to think of somebody who has made a more consistent and more tangible contribution to ufology than Wendy has done. And in particular, with what she has preoccupied herself with over the recent years, namely the
faded discs. Yes.
Yes. That is a very modern and very accessible, and in many ways very easy and convenient way for anybody to get their hands on UFO history. And in a very real sense as well, it's different from picking a book up. Wendy's made this point herself many times. It's as if you're there. You can hear people speaking about the events, and you can hear the emotion in their voice. You can get a sense of how they are as human beings just by listening to them. Books can do so much, and then the rest is to your imagination. And in many ways, that's not a bad thing. But this is reality, UFO reality, is how I would describe Wendy's contribution. And I know she's, you know, not completely disappearing. Her work will be missed.
And she feels is incomplete, and she's put out a staggering number when you think about one woman working away in her little studio down there in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She's put out a staggering number of recordings, MP3 files on CD, which means you get probably an average of 25 to 30 hours of UFO audio history on one CD.
Yes, yes, it's absolutely phenomenal. And we must, in saying that, we must also acknowledge the people that have given her audio recordings, because obviously without their help she wouldn't have been able to do much of what she's done. But it is a fantastic legacy to leave.
Yes.
I also have to say as well that at a personal level, a very sweet lady, and also not somebody you'd want to get on the wrong side of, as I remember somebody called Rich Reynolds once discovered it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And boy, and a certain moderator of a certain UFO email list let something slip out into the world that really shouldn't have, which was definitely an indicator about how Wendy Connors felt about Rich Reynolds.
I think that if it's the... I can remember the posting that you're referring to. She used a phrase which has never left my mind. I don't know if it is a phrase that is peculiar to New Mexico. She said something like, oh, I'm just sat here and noticed there's a honey puddle on the floor. And she was trying to suggest to Mr. Reynolds that he had talked such utter rubbish that she had laughed so much that she'd wet herself. And it was just the terminology and just the way she wrote
yes.
it. It's absolutely classic.
Oh, my. Yeah, I love Wendy Connors, and I really hope that she can continue on working and appearing occasionally on this program, although there's much of her being on this program in the archive.
I've got a lot of her recordings.
Mm-hmm.
It's a joy to listen to them.
Very much so. You know, there's just so much to listen to. I know Alfred Lemberg sits down for hours on end while he's working on his computer and listens to the faded discs that Wendy Connors has put out there at fadeddiscs.com, by the way. And anybody who's relatively new to this field really does need to go and browse there and purchase a disc or two. The price is absolutely amazing for the content.
I got really angry this week.
You did?
I suspect, though, that a lot of people got really angry this week, and I'm referring to the revelation that the former governor of Arizona, Fife Symington, any man with a name like Fife surely can't be trusted in the first place, admitted, what, 10 years after the event or so, that he had indeed witnessed the lights that thousands of people in Phoenix, Arizona, witnessed in March 1997, although he denied it or didn't admit it at the time,
yeah.
And indeed was responsible for that appalling, absurd press conference where he had some clown mince out onto the stage dressed as some alien. And so actually mocked and derided a substantial number of his own constituents.
Yes.
And, of course, that other councillor as well, that lady that was...
Frances Emma Barwood.
Yes.
Yeah.
Driven out of Phoenix in the end, pretty much. It created a stink at the time. I wouldn't say you could understand it or excuse it if it had just been one or two or three people that had claimed to see this, but literally thousands had seen this. And there was this clown that these people had elected appearing on their TV screens, making fun of them. It just confirmed what anybody has ever said about politicians, just a bunch of idiots. Even if there had been some sort of, and I use this word in a non-accusatory sense, even if there had been some sort of conspiracy in the sense that somebody had had a word with him and said, look, play this down. And obviously there's no evidence to suggest that. But even if that had been, that type of message had been passed to him, to go about it, I think it just completely backfired on him. It's not the way I would have chosen to do it. And I think it was extremely insulting and reflected very, very badly on him personally. And I have to say, as a foreigner, in other words, a non-American, it reflected very, very badly on American politics and local politics. And then now, you know, 10 years after, he said, well, actually, I did see it, and I have no idea what it was.
And what puzzles me is, you know, having done what he did 10 years ago at that press conference, why would he come out now and fess up?
Well, was he not asked about it?
Well, presumably he was. I don't know.
Oh, right, but he was asked, you know, about it now. Why? I don't know.
And it wasn't the lights that he saw at 10 o'clock. It was an object earlier on in the evening.
The real sighting.
The real sighting, yes.
Yep.
So much for Fife Symington.
Unfortunately, next week is the 10th anniversary of something altogether less pleasant. That was, or is, the Heaven's Gate affair.
Yeah.
Where, for those people that aren't aware of it, some 39 people.
Yes.
All members of a cult called Heaven's Gate. Just north of San Diego, was it, I think?
Yes, just outside San Diego, and I forget the name of the closed community there, but in a very expensive house in that closed community outside San Diego.
Well, it was a cult led by a gentleman called Marshall Applewhite and his partner, whose name I have temporarily forgotten.
I think that was Bonnie...
I know she was a former psychiatric nurse.
Nurse, yes.
They all took their lives. And they were discovered a short time after by a former cult member who had suspected that something like that was going to happen. And the reason it happened was because of the sighting of the Halley-Bopp comet. And it was their belief that a flying saucer would descend from the tail of the comet and take them all up to a better life, to enlightenment. I personally have found it very interesting observing over the years the reaction to Heaven's Gate. And I've spoken about it before, I remember some years ago on the program. People have got themselves extremely distressed and tend to think of it as a dreadful waste and so on. And of course, the loss of 39 lives is a waste. But the point I've made in the past is that there appeared to be, and there's certainly never been any accusation that these people were in any way coerced into doing what they did. They were all volunteers. You could argue, possibly, that they were brainwashed. We don't know that for sure.
Having seen Marshall Applewhite, on TV actually last night, I was looking at a recording that I'd made from the Learning Channel a couple of weeks ago, and a messianic leader.
Well, he's utterly bonkers. I mean, you sit there looking at his eyes to start with, yes. And that's terrifying enough.
When you say you don't know if they were brainwashed, well, absolutely they were brainwashed. They were cut off from their family. They had their names changed. They just worked together as a group. And all of those things are classic signs of the classic cult. And it's the way that most cults operate, is that they appeal to the searcher that's in a lot of people looking for answers and claim to have the answers, and ensnare them that way. You want to learn ballroom dancing? Do you want to quit smoking? Would you like to know about philosophy? So you go there with an open mind. And so open that your brains fall out and the critical thinking powers go. And some people only have to be there 5 minutes and they're sucked in and they end up doing what Heaven's Gate cult did.
Well, then I truly stand corrected, because I've always tended to believe, even having seen, I've seen videos myself of Marshall, but... I've tended to believe that, by and large, people knew what they were doing.
Not at all. When you hand over your mind like that, it's amazing. I have been involved with doing all kinds of anti-cult work over the years.
Right.
So I have a little bit of an idea of what goes on around those types of organizations.
Well, then let's move on to... Well, just one very brief aside to something that's currently going on in ufology, which is one God almighty bitch fest of a row between Carl Korff, Kevin Randall, and Paul Kimball is fluttering around on the outside of it as well, and even Mac Tonney. And it's an interesting, amusing diversion. And I have to say, as somebody looking at it in a fairly objective manner, it does seem Carl Korff is a bit odd. I'll go no further than that.
A rather strange man.
Yes.
Yes, in among many seemingly strange people. He's another left of left field kind of guy.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
And I must say, I think that Kevin Randall is conducting himself reasonably well, given he's been verbally assaulted a fair bit.
Yes.
And I think that he's, whilst he has kicked back a bit, I think he's conducting himself with a fair degree of decorum.
I find it interesting that Carl Korff has a Middle Eastern sheikh who is sponsoring him and is paying for a forensic examination of Kevin Randall's Roswell UFO evidence.
Well, you're being facetious, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
I'm sorry, I took you for serious there for a moment, and was going to ask you how the hell you believe that. So, yes, you can sell me a bridge any time you want, Errol. I'll probably buy it.
Forensic examination of UFO evidence.
By some of accountants. Anyway, I've treated it very sort of superficially this round, but I was tempted to mention it because it was a very amusing short blog by somebody whose name I don't actually know, who took the what-sits out of all three of them, made fun of them. Ufology as a Catty Girl School, it was titled. And just really got stuck in.
Yes. Well, you know, Carl Korff has always been such an important part of UFO research.
Yes.
Can you hear the tongue planted firmly in my cheek?
Yes, good. Yes.
Really, quite frankly, who cares?
Well, most normal rational people wouldn't.
No. Yes. No.
I was going to mention another story at the risk of profoundly offending Jerry Clark. I'm referring to the story about the fact that Nebraska may have had its own Roswell in 1884. The story that something came down somewhere. And that's about the length and the breadth of the story. And it was supposedly a prank, a hoax. And the trouble with hoaxes is they never go away. And I must say, actually, I think that the reason Jerry Clark got so upset about this is because he did a large amount of research into it. But he's right, actually. People are very reluctant to let go of hoaxes in ufology. Very reluctant. And I suppose, although it was amusing to see him get so upset, I think he has a point.
Yes. And by the way, all of the stories that we've talked about on this program with Stuart Miller are online at UFO Updates, virtuallystrange.net, if you want to read about them further.
Indeed.
Indeed.
I cannot let an episode of Strange Days Indeed go past, Errol, without mentioning the planet Mars, because it's always in the news. And can I just say that as of this moment in time, as we're recording, I'm going to predict that there's going to be a bit of negative news about Mars in the next few days. The reason I say that is because, of course, that is the pattern. And the pattern, or the movement so far over the last week to 2 weeks, has been very positive about Mars. Lots of stories, a couple of which I'm going to mention in a moment, about Mars in a very positive sense. And so we need one that knocks the whole thing on the head, and that's usually the way it goes. And one will emerge within the next few days, mark my words. The two major stories about Mars within the space of 3 days or so. First one was this discovery of a voluminous amount of ice underneath the South Pole at Mars. Depending on who you read, enough water there to flood the planet by 6 feet or 11 feet. So I think that rather knocks the argument or the question about water on Mars.
It is somewhat supported by the fact that Mars at some point in its history, and not in recent history, was hit by an asteroid or a comet which pushed all the waters on the surface of Mars to the pole, where it froze.
Yes. But closely associated with that has also been the announcement, I think it was by NASA, of the discovery of underground caves. Now, it's associated with the discovery of these vast reservoirs of water because, of course, always in the bottom of these caves, or it is a potential spot for life, and it means that, you know, there is shelter from the harsh atmosphere, etc., etc.
Yeah.
One of the caves has indeed been named after, as I think Bruce Maccabee pointed out, Wendy Connors. Well, it's called Wendy. I don't know whether it's actually called Wendy Connors.
Yes, but we like to think it's named for Wendy Connors. It's appropriate.
Well, yes, I'm sure. In the nicest possible way.
Of course.
Yes. It's all getting terribly exciting about that lump of rock 33 million miles away, and it just seems to be positive news coming out time and time again, and seems to be only a matter of time before somebody turns around, oh, yes, yes, there's life up there, we can prove it now. And
yeah.
A very depressing, I found it depressing, article this week by a gentleman called Robert Shapiro, and it appeared in an online magazine called Space Review about the reasons why we need to go back to the moon. There's been one or two articles lately, very interesting ones actually, justifying the space program, because of course one of the biggest criticisms of the space program is the vast sums of money spent on it, and couldn't that money be used to, quote, sort things out down here, quote, instead of wasting it, you know, sending astronauts or even robots. The reason I found it depressing was because Robert Shapiro wants to use the moon almost as a CD backup of Earth. He seems to be utterly convinced that we are going to just totally screw this place up. He puts a strong argument. If we want to survive as a species, then the moon it must be. Now, obviously, this isn't a new concept. People have been going on about this for a long, long time, that, you know, in order for man to survive, for the human species to carry on, we are going to have to get off this planet at some point. And I think there may well be people listening to this, Errol, if they are young enough, who may end up doing that. I don't think it's that far off, relatively speaking. I regret that probably you and I won't see it. I think we'll both be lucky to see people actually walking on the planet surface of Mars. But I don't think initial stages of colonization elsewhere will be too far behind.
Project Noah, huh?
Well, yes.
Noah's Ark.
It's the reasons he just went into, you know, he just painted a very sort of bleak picture of how he saw us stewarding this planet. It's an article that's worth reading, Space Review, Robert Shapiro.
Okay, if you send me the link, I'll put it up, if you haven't sent it to me already.
Okay, yes, no, I don't think I have, actually.
Okay.
I will send it to you.
Good. So are you going to leave us on that depressing note?
No, I am going to leave you on that depressing note, always leave you down.
I can't begin to tell you how much I appreciate it, Stuart. I've been down so long, it looks like up to me.
It's always my pleasure.
Thank you, Stuart Miller.
Okay. All
the best. Okay. And to you, sir. And we'll talk to you in about 3 or 4 weeks. Thanks, Stuart.
Okay.
Bye.
As I was standing looking up one day, enjoying the view across the way, some big bright lights came flying by, a lot of whirling doodads in the sky. It's just imagination, but I saw them just the same.
Just imagination, but we saw them just the same.
Leslie Kane is an investigative journalist whose articles have appeared in numerous newspapers and magazines around the world. She has written for many, many newspapers and publications. A woman who has been read all over the world. Leslie Kane is the co-founder of the Washington-based Coalition for Freedom of Information. And if we have time, we'll maybe get into a little bit of that. But the reason that Leslie is with us on this program is because of the coming forth of the former governor of Arizona, Fife Symington. And Leslie Kane joins us on the phone from New York City. Hello, Leslie.
Hello, Errol. Great to be with you today.
It's good to have you back on the program. So can you take us back and step us through the way that you discovered that Fife Symington had a UFO sighting on the night of March 13th, 1997?
Yeah, sure. I actually found out from close friend and colleague James Fox, who is one of the producers of the film Out of the Blue, which probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with. It's a UFO documentary.
We had James on this program, in fact, a couple of years ago when it first came out.
Yeah, it first came out a number of years ago, as you mentioned, and James decided he wanted to kind of do a revival. He wanted to see if he could improve the film, add some new material, and kind of redo the whole thing for a new release. And in the process of doing that, he went to interview Fife Symington. He just thought, why not? I'll ask him about that press conference that he held in 1997. And he just thought he'd probably get some fairly matter-of-fact explanation as to why the guy did it, and this guy was probably a debunker and wouldn't say a whole lot. So he went to see Mr. Symington to interview him for Out of the Blue, and that's when he came out with this extraordinary information.
In 2006, we caught up with Governor Symington to find out what really happened and whether he believed the military's explanation that the Phoenix lights were just flares.
I was never satisfied with the explanation that they were high-altitude flares. It didn't look like that. It was all too symmetrical. And it clearly had a shape to it, and a big shape, and it was a constant shape. You can't control flares that way. There's just no way they were flares.
It came to me because James and I communicate a lot, and we decided that the 10th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights would be an excellent time to actually break the story and to get people ready to receive the Out of the Blue, which will be coming out in a couple of months, and be a way to kind of promote the film along with getting the news out at a very important moment, which was the 10th anniversary, which unfortunately my story missed that by 3 or 4 days due to a lot of tie-ups I had with national media where I was trying to break the story first, and I ended up breaking it in Arizona media, but that's another story. But it was really through James that I found out about his admissions about this, and then I ended up conducting my own detailed interview with him and in cooperation with James. He wanted to add some more material to his section on the Phoenix Lights, and he's also added some tremendous new material to his section on the Bentwaters case in that documentary. Those two cases have been really improved with new witnesses and very important witnesses.
So oh, good.
It was in that context that he hadn't interviewed him originally for Out of the Blue. I don't know why. It just somehow didn't happen, and he got the idea to do it this time around. That's why it happened just now as opposed to later. And when James initially asked him for the interview, he said, send me a copy of the film, and James sent him a copy of the film, and he really liked it. Called up James and said he was willing to do an interview, so that's how it all happened.
You've only known about this, I guess, in the last few weeks.
Well, no, much longer than that, but we've just kept it under wraps, actually, because James wanted to work on the film. He didn't want it to get out before we were ready for it to come out.
Understood, yes.
We wanted to wait for the 10th anniversary to bring it forward, so... Mm-hmm. And we wanted to give James some time to actually get the film ready. So that's why we waited till now.
This is all very odd to me, that this man, the governor of Arizona, would, first of all, not join the many thousands of his constituents who had these various sightings, and we're not talking about the flare drop at 10 o'clock, but various sightings around Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Why he wouldn't come out and say that he had had the sighting, that's A. And B, why on earth would he hold that ridiculous press conference that made all his constituents who had these sightings look like morons?
I know. Well, that's what's sort of so fascinating about all of this. And I hope your readers will read the story that I wrote about this, which is on my website, because I do give you the answers that he gave to those questions, particularly the one about why he gave the press conference, which was, and again, I think I'm going to learn more from him over time. But the first, you know, in this beginning phase with him, I asked him certain questions, and I only wanted to go so far. I didn't want him to feel pressured or harassed. So although I, too, have a lot more questions I'd like to have answered, we have only so much information at this point. But what he said about the press conference particularly was, as I wrote in my story, that he felt there was too much hysteria about this UFO sighting and that people were just kind of overreacting and freaking out. And he wanted people to calm down, basically. He was concerned that people were frightened and hysterical. So he thought this press conference would introduce a little levity, was the way he put it, and help people lighten up about the whole situation. Now, to us, that may seem very odd, but that's how he describes his motivation for doing the press conference. He also says that it was entirely his idea. A lot of people are speculating whether he may have been pressured to do this, which is a reasonable question.
Yeah, that had occurred to me, too.
He says that was not the case, and it was his idea. And all I can tell you is what he has said. So I want to talk to other people that were around at the time, and I do want to try to find out more, if I can, about all of this. But
yes.
For right now, that's about what we know. In terms of why he didn't talk about it then, I'm getting a little more insight into that as well. Like, I know that also he was in political office then, and it's very difficult for people that are holding political office to make statements like that and not deal with all kinds of ridicule and difficulties that they might have to face.
Yes.
Plus, he was, you know, dealing with some very difficult political situations at that time. So I think it was a whole conglomeration of things that he just felt he didn't want to talk about it. So I agree with you. It's a strange situation. It just adds to the interest and the power of this whole situation is that this guy who actually was debunking it has now come around and said the opposite. I don't know how often that happens, but not very often.
And it also begs the question, so why were those flares dropped at 17,000 feet over Phoenix at 10 o'clock that evening? It adds fuel to the cover-up, to the distraction.
I know, and I know I'm no expert on that, but I know there are people, of course, that are much more knowledgeable than I am about that, the flare question, who would, I think, believe that, yes, as you say, that they call them intentional flares, that they perhaps were dropped to sort of so they could have something to say, well, look, this is what it was. Of course, they didn't admit it for months that they did drop the flares, so the whole thing is a mess. You know? I haven't really studied it in that kind of depth. I wish I knew a little more about that, but I'm not an expert on the Phoenix Lights, or the way a lot of other people are.
Yeah.
I just have this story about Symington, and I hope to learn more over a period of time about it. He seems very confident and committed to this situation, and he could really help us.
Yes.
You know? I'd like to find out more from people who knew him at the time and might have some insight into what actually happened with him and with the press conference and all of that.
Are his staff still working in governmental positions in Arizona, do we know?
That's something I want to find out about as well. I believe his chief of staff, who was the one who was dressed up in the costume, is not anymore.
Mm.
But, of course, there were others.
Yes.
And that's a whole undertaking in itself to try to locate those people and find out. So I'll hope to have more answers down the road about all of that.
And, of course, the CNN report last night, he's the most senior government official to say that he'd had a UFO sighting. We completely forgot about Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan, who had three UFO sightings, and
Jimmy Carter.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, but there's something about this one, because it wasn't just a light in the sky. And unfortunately,
yes,
you know, the CNN had him say that he saw lights, and then they cut it.
Mm-hmm.
The point I was trying to make in my story, which is just so important, is that he is very clear that he saw a solid craft. It was not just a bunch of lights. He described it as having shape, you know, an outline to it. It was a geometric solid form. And I think that distinction really has to be made. And when you talk about Carter's sighting or the others, they were much further away.
Yes.
They weren't seen by 1,000 other people. So I think there's something exceptional about his coming out about this, because he saw something much closer up, much more detailed. And he's got the backing of all the other people in Arizona who saw it.
Yes.
So that's probably what the guy meant. But he was also, the reporter probably wasn't aware of the others. But
probably not.
You know, it's not quite at the same level when you see a light or something like that.
Yes. And, of course, it was illustrated by what we've come to know as the flares in behind J.D. John Roberts when he was setting up the piece, too.
I know. And then they always show those tapes. All through the piece, they were showing those pictures. I don't think the media is capable of doing this story without...
They've got to have the visuals.
They
got to have the visuals.
I know. It's just that it really is very frustrating to a lot of the witnesses I've talked to also.
I'm sure.
Who don't like to see those two sightings mixed up. But that's why I really tried to emphasize that in my story, to make that distinction. And the witnesses I've spoken to were very happy. They say no other media has ever done that before. They always just lump it all together, you know, and have the picture of those flares, and that's it.
Yes.
I've been told that most likely they were flares, and I've looked at enough evidence to suggest that to me that they were most likely flares. But
yes, but why they were dropped at 17,000 feet and that pathetic story about, well, we didn't want to line with the flares. Well, those things are worth, I don't know, $6,000 or $7,000 a piece, and you just don't dump them when you're landing.
Crazy.
We've had several people on the program who are pilots. Alfred Lemberg himself was a chopper pilot, flew those kinds of flares, and they would have been in deep, deep caca if they dumped those flares off and not brought
them
back. The stories are just preposterous.
And there are so many stories like this. We all know about them, but it just never seems to break through a certain level of barrier that exists because the status quo is not willing to acknowledge this. You know, one story after another, and it just, I think that people know about them, but it doesn't break through whatever it is that we're trying to break through. Nothing seems to. As long as the government is denying this, then there's going to be only so far we can go, I guess, unless something really, really dramatic happens.
As I said to John Hilkovich, who broke the O'Hare story,
right.
I'm so glad you got on board, because he's not going to let this go, and any other UFO stories as related to airlines and passenger safety and pilots, he's not going to pass by anymore. He's going to climb on that and add it to his repertoire, if you like.
That's fantastic. I look forward to hearing your interview with him. I've spoken to him myself a number of times, but I'd be very interested to hear what he said on your interview.
I had done actually two broadcast programs at the beginning of the year on the O'Hare incident, and that's in podcast number 2.
Great.
This being number 3, yes. And, of course, the CNN report last night, he's the most senior government official to say that he'd had a UFO sighting. We completely forgot about Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan, who had 3 UFO sightings, and
Jimmy Carter.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, but there's something about this one, because it wasn't just a light in the sky. And unfortunately,
yes.
You know, the CNN had him say that he saw lights, and then they cut it.
Mm-hmm.
The point I was trying to make in my story, which is just so important, is that he is very clear that he saw a solid craft. It was not just a bunch of lights. He described it as having shape, you know, an outline to it. It was a geometric solid form. And I think that distinction really has to be made. And when you talk about Carter's sighting or the others, they were much further away.
Yes.
They weren't seen by 1,000 other people. So I think there's something exceptional about his coming out about this, because he saw something much closer up, much more detailed. And he's got the backing of all the other people in Arizona who saw it.
Yes.
So that's probably what the guy meant. But he was also, the reporter probably wasn't aware of the others, but...
Probably not.
You know, it's not quite at the same level when you see a light or something like that.
Yes, and of course it was illustrated by what we've come to know as the flares in behind J.D. John Roberts when he was setting up the piece, too.
I know, and then they always show those tapes. All through the piece they were showing this. I don't think the media is capable of doing this story without...
They've got to have the visuals.
They
got to have the visuals.
I know. It's just that it really is very frustrating to a lot of the witnesses I've talked to also.
I'm sure.
Who don't like to see those two sightings mixed up. But that's why I really tried to emphasize that in my story, to make that distinction. And the witnesses I've spoken to were very happy. They say no other media has ever done that before. They always just lump it all together. You know, and have the picture of those flares, and that's it.
Yes.
I've been told that most likely they were flares, and I've looked at enough evidence to suggest that to me that they were most likely flares. But
yes, but why they were dropped at 17,000 feet, and that pathetic story about, well, we didn't want to land with the flares. Well, those things are worth, I don't know, $6,000 or $7,000 a piece, and you just don't dump them when you're landing.
Crazy.
We've had several people on the program who are pilots. Alfred Lemberg himself was a chopper pilot, flew those kinds of flares, and they would have been in deep, deep caca if they dumped those flares off and not brought
really
them
wild.
Back. The stories are just preposterous.
And there are so many stories like this. We all know about them, but it just never seems to break through a certain level of barrier that exists because the status quo is not willing to acknowledge this. You know, one story after another, and it just, I think that people know about them, but it doesn't break through whatever it is that we're trying to break through. Nothing seems to. As long as the government is denying this, then there's going to be only so far we can go, I guess, unless something really, really dramatic happens.
As I said to John Hilkovich, who broke the O'Hare story,
right.
I'm so glad you got on board, because he's not going to let this go, and any other UFO stories as related to airlines and passenger safety and pilots, he's not going to pass by anymore. He's going to climb on that and add it to his repertoire, if you like.
That's fantastic. I look forward to hearing your interview with him. I've spoken to him myself a number of times, but I'd be very interested to hear what he said on your interview.
I had done actually two broadcast programs at the beginning of the year on the O'Hare incident, and that's in podcast number 2.
Great.
This being number 3, yes. Leslie, I want to thank you for letting me know that Bud Hopkins is okay again.
Bud Hopkins is doing very well, and he's being productive. He's doing some artwork, and he's working on the UFO stuff that he does.
Good. Give us your website before
we go. Okay, the website is www.freedomofinfo.org. So it's basically short for Freedom of Information, freedomofinfo.org. And I really do hope that people will read the story I wrote, because so much of the additional coverage that comes out about issues like this is so incomplete, and you just get sound bites here and sound bites there, and for instance, like what they did on CNN. And it's not because I wrote the story, but I want people to have the full picture and to have the right context for everything that the governor said. So that's why I hope people will read it.
Thank you so much for filling us in on some of the background on this. And
okay.
Look forward to talking to you again about it real soon.
Well, thank you. And thanks again for doing that, having UFO updates and doing all that you do. Big contribution.
And I'm glad you're around, too.
Thank you very much, Errol.
Thank you, Leslie Kane. As a young man, Dennis Balthaser would look into the night sky and wonder at the secrets that it held. Some years later, Dennis bought a book about UFOs, and his wonder turned to investigation. Dennis Balthaser served 3 years from 59 to 62 with the United States Army in the 815th Engineering Battalion. And after 33 years in civil engineering, Dennis retired from the Texas Department of Transportation back in 96. And having been keenly interested in the Roswell incident of 1947, Dennis decided to move to Roswell, New Mexico, to pursue his avocation, ufology. Initially, Dennis worked as an engineering consultant in Roswell, volunteering his time at the International UFO Museum and Research Center on weekends. 9 months later, he resigned from the engineering firm, assuming the duties of the museum's operations manager. He served on the board of directors and became the UFO investigator for the museum as a full-time volunteer. Dennis is regarded as a leading investigator and ufologist by his peers. Currently, in that Dennis is no longer affiliated with the museum, he's able to devote his full time as an independent researcher investigator to the Roswell incident, Area 51, and underground bases research, and frequently lectures on these and other topics related to ufology. Dennis is a certified Mutual UFO Network field investigator, a member of the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association, and he belongs to several ufology organizations. You can find his website at truthseeker@roswell.com. That's truthseeker@roswell.com. And joining us on the line is the truth seeker himself from Roswell, New Mexico. Here's Dennis Balthaser.
Good morning, hello.
You have broadened your horizons as far as research is concerned in the last few years, and I get the feeling that you, like me, are a firm believer that UFOs are ancients. They've been coming here for thousands of years, millennia.
Well, I think there's a lot of evidence to support that, going back to the Bible. In fact, the book of Ezekiel talks about flying fiery wheels, and there's a lot of information available about 13th and 14th century artwork and tapestries that depict what appear to be UFOs in the paintings and in the tapestry. And these artists had to know or see something in order to depict what they did on their craft.
that would certainly make sense, wouldn't it? When you read, when you hear about old cultures attempting to define what it is that they've seen, you get these amazing cave paintings, cave drawings, and how would primitive people describe what it is that they're seeing, as was done in the Bible? They came down with straight feet, leaving marks in the sand, mm-hmm. like a cloven hoof, etc., etc., etc. You can only extrapolate that information one way, and that's they were seeing beings from elsewhere, or beings that were far in advance of their culture and civilization.
One of the things that I'd like to research, Earl, and I'm having difficulty obtaining information, is some history on some of the Native Americans, the Indians of the United States and North America. They have tremendous knowledge of the star systems. They talk about the Seven Sisters and different things. The Hopi Indians out of Arizona supposedly came from within the earth. Many of these various tribes of Native Americans have had experience. I talked to one guy one time who was a Native American and asked him, why don't you talk about it? And he said, nobody asked, which I thought was fascinating. And that's typical of the Native American, that they don't talk about things unless talked to. So I have a portion of my website, I've got a few links to some Native Americans, and I'm always looking for more because I'm fascinated with what they might know.
The Native Americans that I've spoken to all have knowledge. It's part of their culture, the sky people.
Well, the Egyptians, too. The pyramids themselves are lined up exactly like the three stars in Orion's belt in the constellation. So, you know, this goes back many, many years. We all think it started in 1947 with Roswell, but you can even look at newspapers from all over the country prior to 1947 that have articles about things that were seen in the sky that were not identifiable.
It's really amazing, isn't it, that when you start to dig deeper into those old cultures, as you have, you become quite involved with the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association. What kind of evidence have you been finding there?
Well, the advisory board that I was asked to join a few years ago is headed by John DeSalvo out of Minnesota, and he has put together about 30 individuals from all over the world, people from Canada, Ukraine, Italy, India, France, Malta, and the United States, which are mostly comprised of scientists, physicists, Egyptologists, engineers. And I was really curious why they wanted a ufologist on this advisory board. And once I agreed to join the board, I found out that many of those on the board are convinced that the Great Pyramids of Giza, the three big pyramids in Giza and the Sphinx, are more than likely not built by the Egyptians. They're older than the Egyptian civilization. And we have documentation now to pretty well prove that the Great Pyramid was not built for a pharaoh as a burial chamber. It's fascinating research for me because of my civil engineering background, for one thing, and just the fact that we know so little about the pyramids. We cannot today build anything as accurate as the pyramids are built. I've spent 33 years building bridges and highways in Texas with the most advanced technology available, and some of that doesn't even compare with what the Egyptian built, what the pyramids had been. Stephen Mueller, one of our researchers who frequently goes to Egypt to do research, has found that there was a civilization in North Africa known as Khemitians, K-H-E-M-I-T-I-A-N, who he believes are well over 10,000 years old. He wrote a book called The Land of Osiris, which he believes, and others believe, there was an advanced prehistoric civilization in Egypt, in North Africa. So the question is, could the Khemitians have built the pyramids? We think maybe they could have, and we also have heard that they had contact with star people. So my theory is that the pyramids were not built by extraterrestrials, but the technology and knowledge to build them could have come from star people, handed down to the Khemitians, which would have meant that they were built prior to the Egyptian civilization.
Do we have a date, a rough epoch, when the Khemitians were around?
10,000 to 15,000 years ago. which predates the Egyptian civilization.
Hmm.
And that's the key right there, is the fact that this civilization, it was a predominantly black, controlled by the female gender, and there's a lot of resemblance on the face of the Sphinx to what a North African female might have looked like. Whether that's the original face, we don't know. But this is something that we need to really, really pursue, because if true, then we have pretty well documented information that the three pyramids of Giza were probably not built by the Egyptians. However, there's probably 85, 90 pyramids in Egypt that were built by the Egyptians at a later time. And if you look at those and compare them with the three of Giza, there is no comparison to the workmanship, the technology, the size, or anything else. They're all poor replicas of the original three.
And if they had originally built those three, one of two explanations, either the ones that are lying around the various parts of Egypt were practice pyramids before the Great Pyramid was built, or they were attempting to imitate, duplicate the engineering.
That's our thinking, that it was duplication or an attempt at a duplication, and basically really failed as far as duplicating. We have always been concerned on how they were built. We don't know how the three pyramids were built. There's no documentation anywhere. The possibility of using water or sound may someday prove to have been a key factor as a means of overcoming gravity to handle these gigantic stones. And of course, the precise accuracy of cutting them is amazing. A 50th of an inch between some of the rocks, and the weight of them anywhere from 2 to 70 tons, 400 some feet in the air. The biggest problem we're going to have, Errol, is convincing the world that the Egyptian pyramids of Giza are not Egyptian, because tourism is big business in Egypt. And they push that a lot. And for us to come out and say, well, fine, but your three pyramids were not built by you. They have always said that the Great Pyramid was built for Khufu, who was a pharaoh of the 4th dynasty about 2600 B.C. But historical records indicate that he was not buried in the Great Pyramid. It's our belief that the Sphinx and the pyramids are much older than we've been told by the modern-day Egyptologists. The Arabs were the first to go in the pyramid, in the Big Pyramid, in 820 A.D., and the only thing they found was an empty granite box in the king's chamber called a coffer. And that was an empty, lidless box, uninscribed, undecorated, and most certainly would have been covered with hieroglyphics and paintings had the pharaoh been placed in there, as was custom with the Egyptians when preparing them for the afterlife.
Yeah.
It's the only pyramid that has both ascending and descending passages, possibly air shafts. Other pyramids only have descending passages. So dead pharaohs don't need air, so why were airships spilled into these pyramids?
There was also a story, and I don't know how real it is, or a suggestion that because of the angles that these passages climb up to the exterior wall, if you put mirrors on the angles, whoever lay in the sarcophagus in the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid would have the light of Sirius at a certain point of the year fall upon what we know as the third eye center in the middle of the forehead. And I don't know if you've come across that story or not.
I've heard that, and I've also heard the theory on sound, that the sound inside the great room is so much different than any other sound. The personal feelings that people develop after being inside there have been talked about. The original pyramids were covered with a highly polished limestone casing stone, which acted like gigantic mirrors to reflect sunlight, and they probably were so powerful that they would have been visible from the moon. Those were all removed by the Arabs about the 14th century to build their own mosque, so there's no evidence of the shiny limestone still remaining on the pyramids.
All through history, and as recently as Napoleonic times, when Napoleon took the French army into Egypt, supposedly just so that he could spend the night in the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid.
The pyramids have been researched for the past 400 or 500 years, including Napoleon Bonaparte in 1798. He had an expedition that accompanied him not only by his military, but by engineers, surveyors, astronomers, artists, and archaeologists. And their work was published in several volumes between 1809 and 22 by order of Napoleon, and he was supposedly visibly shaken after spending time alone in the king's chamber and refused to ever talk about it again. Some say he was given a vision of his destiny while he was alone inside the king's chamber.
Mm-hmm. Then, of course, there's the story of the missing time in Jesus of Nazareth's life. Mm-hmm. And legend or myth, don't know which, has it that he spent the night in the king's chamber too. So it still is an initiation chamber.
Right. I've always been amazed, as a Christian, which surprises a lot of people that I'd be a Christian and a UFO researcher, but I have no problem with either one of them. I've always been amazed I cannot find much reference, if any, in the Bible to the pyramids, which should be there because of Moses and the time frame they talk about with the pharaohs and everything that went on in Egypt before the Israelis fled there. But I can't find anything. Now, there is a documentary out, I think it's called The Pillars of Enoch, and I'm trying to locate that to look at it. An ex-National Football League player basically believes what I believe, that they're older than the Egyptian civilization, and apparently he does some explanation in that documentary. I want to get a hold of him or get a hold of the documentary and see what I can learn from that.
That would be interesting. And yeah, the Book of Enoch is one of the missing books of the Old Testament.
He believes that the Pillar of Enoch, which he refers to, is in fact the Great Pyramid, which would be a tremendous tie to put it all together, perhaps. So I'm going to start working on that and see what I can do with that. Another one of our advisory board members, Joe Parr, spent an entire night on top of the Great Pyramid on two separate occasions in 97 and 1998 conducting electrical, magnetic, and radioactive measurements, and he's been able to measure an energy field or a bubble that forms around the pyramid. And the energy field appears to vary with the 11-year sunspot cycle. And it appears that the Great Pyramid was never finished on top. There's about a 30 by 30 foot flat area up on top, and that's where he was on those two different occasions.
Also is interesting that back in the late 60s, mid 70s, a lot of people were really into pyramid power, myself included.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a small scale model of the Great Pyramid of Cheops on the Giza Plateau, made of coat hanger wire, basically. And about one third of the way up, right in the middle, I put a block. And on that block, because I had heard that pyramid power would keep my razor blade sharp, so I put it in there. And I used the same razor blade for many, many, many months without any problem at all.
Are you saying then that it doesn't matter the composition of the pyramid, it's the shape, do you think, that causes the energy? Because you said coat hangers.
Yes, you could get cardboard ones back in those days. My dad put large wire pyramids over tomato plants and grew the most astoundingly large, tasty tomatoes. And, of course, he had control groove around it, too, because that was the nature of my dad. But the things that grew under the pyramid frames were just far, far superior to those that didn't.
Well, on this same topic, let me share a little information that we've gathered. One of our Ukrainian board members, Vladimir Krasnolovits, and I love it when I can say that name.
I can say Balthazar.
Don't ask to say it again. This is a gentleman from the Ukraine, former Russia. And in Ukraine, using large pyramids recently built by the Russian National Academy of Sciences in the Ukraine, they've discovered that immune systems of organisms increased upon exposure in the pyramid. Agriculture seeds placed in the pyramid for, I think, 1 to 5 days showed a 30% increase in yield. Violent weather decreased in the area of the pyramid. The potency for pharmaceuticals increased with decreasing side effects. And the pyramids decreased the strength of various viruses and bacteria. But the real kicker, ordinary water does not freeze at 40 below zero and retains its properties for years, while synthesized diamonds turn out harder and purer when placed inside the pyramid.
How does that happen? Has anybody come up with an answer to that?
Not yet. That's the results they got from the testing they did. They have no idea how it happened, why it happened, or what causes it to happen.
I have a friend who built a home north of Toronto up in the bush, and he built it exactly, precisely to scale of the Great Pyramid. And he put his bedroom where the King's Chamber would be. And he managed to spend one night in there and never slept in there again.
Fascinating.
And there are all kinds of these stories around, and they're not stories, they're actual factual reports of people's experiences with the pyramid.
Well, yeah, the one in Ukraine, we're talking the Russian National Academy of Sciences. It's not a fly-by-night organization by any means.
So I wonder why modern manufacturing processes are not incorporating that design into their manufacturing.
I don't know. I shouldn't say it, but maybe like ufology, maybe they know something they don't want us to know. I don't know that.
Of course, there was a lot of stupidity going on around that, too. The Toronto Maple Leafs hockey team's coach had pyramids placed beneath the player's bench in the hope that it would improve their performance.
Did or didn't?
Didn't.
Didn't. Maybe it doesn't work all the time, huh?
Well, it does. I think pointing one of those things up between your buttocks is not a great help.
Right.
You need to be in that King's Chamber area.
Be careful what you wish for.
Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of meditators who say that they have just the most amazing experiences. They built replicas made out of copper piping. They sit and meditate underneath the pyramid, and you get these amazing effects.
Recently, I had the opportunity to visit with an old high school classmate, and her husband had gone to Egypt, and she had gone in the pyramid. And she came out, she said she was a totally different person from being inside the pyramid, just the feeling she got while being inside. She doesn't know what caused it, but she definitely felt it. And I've heard that from several other people.
There have also been stories of people who have both been in the Great Pyramid and have been inside crop circles.
Yeah.
And have gotten that same feeling.
Right.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I've heard that too. The thing, I guess, for me that has been fascinating with my engineering background is the factual information that we know about the pyramids. And after devoting 36 years to civil engineering, it's almost incomprehensible to me. The size, the materials, things like that, such as the Great Pyramid, is composed of 2.5 million blocks of limestone. That's enough to build 30 Empire State Buildings. The base covers 13 acres, has a volume of about 90 million cubic feet, 454 feet high, which is equivalent to about a 48-story building, 203 steps to the summit. Each side slopes up at an angle of exactly 51 degrees, 51 minutes, and each side has an area of 5.5 acres, with less than a 50th of an inch separating some of the blocks with optical precision. So whoever built the pyramids knew what they were doing. And they're the only wonder of the original seven wonders of the world still remaining, which is surprising because with that much weight and size, over this period of time, they should have begun to sink into the surface, and they have not, which indicates they had tremendous knowledge of sub-base materials or what was under the ground, under the surface. There's stories that perhaps there's a mountain range that runs around the equator in that area that could have been known and support this amount of weight. But it's just fascinating to even imagine how they were built. The Egyptologists tell us that they used several tens of thousands of people, and it took 20 or 30 years. Well, if you calculate the number of stones, the size, the height, they would have had to place one of those stones every 90 seconds. And they had to be brought in from some other area of Egypt. That material for building it wasn't there. They had to cut them in quarries, load them on a craft of some kind on the Nile, bring them down, and we have evidence of possibly some canals that ran from the Nile over to Giza. The Nile today, the Nile River today, is about 9 miles west of where it was originally. Just cutting the stones and transporting them would have been an undertaking that It's just unimaginable.
It just boggles the mind as to, you know, how many generations it would have taken to do that.
Yeah, and for what purpose if there's nothing been found inside?
Yes.
I mean, if they're going to keep insisting that they were built for a pharaoh, then there should be some evidence of remains for the afterlife.
It's a mystery that will endure along with UFOs, I guess, huh?
It's one of those things that I kind of came in backwards on and was fascinated with for many years and then fortunate enough to be invited on this advisory board. The main reason we think that the three pyramids of Giza are older than we've been told by the Egyptologists is the Sphinx, because the Sphinx has obvious deterioration on the back from water, not from sand or wind. And there hasn't been enough water in that part of the world for 15,000 years to do that type of deterioration.
Yay, Robert Schock.
The Sphinx itself was covered up to the neck until the 1800s, and when the sand was removed in the 1800s, the body of the lion appeared, including the outstretched paws. We, some researchers, have done research on the paw, and I don't remember if it's a left or right, but they have done some ground-penetrating radar, and there is a cavity inside one of those paws. We are of the belief that perhaps, and we don't know, but perhaps some type documentation is in there that would say how the pyramids were built, because we can't find anything anywhere in Egypt to indicate how they were built. Also, possibly some information about Atlantis, but for some reason, the tourism industry won't let researchers go into the paw at this time. We're hoping eventually to be able to get in there and do some research and see what we can find.
Again, I've heard stories of the Lord High Poobah there in the Egyptian Antiquities Organization.
Hawass.
Zahi Hawass.
Yeah.
Who has been a major pain in the buttocks for a lot of researchers. Jealously guards his fiefdom there.
Yep. I think he's probably on the payroll of the tourism industry, and he's obviously biased in his documentaries and his information. I understand he may be retiring, and we're hoping that he retires and someone else will come in and we can go a different direction.
Yeah, someone who won't have his hand out for handouts.
I know the Egyptian government is trying to recover many of the artifacts that have been taken out over the years and grave robbers that have gone in there and put them in museums all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a problem with that. I think Egypt deserves to have their artifacts. I don't know that it's a bad idea because that way it can be shared with the world, but I think they have a valid point maybe wanting that. But I don't know that they need to stay with this. There are the three pyramids are Egyptian. We don't believe that.
So the contention, it would seem, among the organization, the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association, that there appears to be a link between those antiquities and the beings that we feel are visiting us. Is that a correct assessment on my part?
I assume that's correct in that they asked me to be on the board, and I was honored, you know, to be asked to be on this board. I'm pretty high-tech people there on the board, and it opened a door for me to the possibility of trying to help find out who built them.
I trust that someday somebody will, and I have the very strong feeling that it'll all tie back to the topic that primarily concerns us on this program, and that's unidentified flying objects.
Right.
Can we come back around now full circle?
Sure.
You're no longer involved with the Roswell International UFO Museum, but you are involved with this year's Roswell 60th Anniversary Festival, which is coming up in July of this year.
July 5th through the 8th will be the 60th anniversary, if you can believe it, of the
Amazing.
Roswell incident. I was involved with the 50th back in 1997 when I was a volunteer at the museum. We had 40,000 people in Roswell, which nearly doubled the population.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hopeful that this year we'll equal that or better it. It's been handled by the UFO Museum for the last few years and not overly successful in the attendance, and there was very little community involvement, and the mayor of Roswell decided this year for the 60th anniversary the city would take it over, so he appointed three co-chair people, and we have a committee of about 15 or 16 individuals from the city who work for the city, businesses, myself as a researcher, and invited us to put together a planning committee, and we're starting to get national grant money from some big national companies to help support it. We have about 30 speakers coming in for the four-day event. And the big thing this year is that we were contacted by some of the ufologists from Mexico, from old Mexico, and they are very excited about coming and sharing their research from Mexico, which we're looking forward to because we don't have many symposiums that do this. So the first day will be devoted to 6 speakers from Mexico who will be doing their lectures in both Spanish and English and sharing their research from Mexico with the audience. And a few of the names of speakers that will be here are Richard Dolan, John Greenewald Jr., who has the Black Vault and does all the Freedom of Information requests, Peter Robbins, Michael Heiser, Nick Redfern, John Rhodes, Greg Bishop, myself, and many, many others. We have so many speakers that we actually have 2 venues. There's going to be a lot of overlapping, so people will have to go to the festival website, RoswellUFOFestival.com, and decide which speakers they want to hear because it will be overlapping. There are going to be some that will be at the Bassett Auditorium, which is at the Roswell Museum and Art Center, and then at the Convention Center, which is adjacent to the Art Center, there will be speakers also. And this will run from about 9 in the morning till 6 or 7 every night, constantly with the speakers in both venues.
Ooh, that's going to make a lot of people crazy.
Yeah, it will. They'll have to decide who they want to hear and when they want to be there.
Exactly.
The mayor's desire, when he put us all together, was that this be a family-oriented festival, and that it also be a community involvement festival, which we haven't had in the past. So for the serious UFO people, we have plenty of speakers and plenty of information that will be available. They'll have a vendor table set up in the convention center where the visitors can buy products from the speakers or talk to them. But then for the family-oriented stuff, there is a full schedule every day starting about 7 in the morning and running up till midnight. This includes an alien corn maze, which will be in the area where people can go into a field of corn in a maze.
Yes.
That'll be open every day.
You've got to be careful there. Build it and they shall come.
That's right. There'll be alien hot air balloon rides every morning, depending on weather, up till about 9 o'clock. Helicopter rides. There will be, I think, 30-minute helicopter rides over the city of Roswell. The kids' events will begin at Rusty K. Field. They'll run from 10 in the morning till midnight. Murphy Brothers Carnival, who has the New Mexico and Missouri State Fair, it's a large carnival. They'll be here. Intergalactic Music Festival. Alan Parsons Project Concerts at the Wool Bowl.
There's a man whom I've long admired, played him a lot on the radio on FM back in the 70s, and wonderful music.
Oh, he puts together some great shows.
I bet, and put that together with lights, and that's going to be quite an experience.
What the mayor is hopeful of is that we will have so much activity in those 4 days that people will have to come back to Roswell. It's a moneymaker for Roswell, and as a researcher, I've had problems in the past with the carnival atmosphere and things like that, but I suppose it's all part of it.
Yes.
We will have the UFO stuff for the serious people or those with curiosity, and then we'll have the family-oriented stuff for other people to enjoy.
I'm sure it'll be wonderful. I had a magnificent time when I was down there in 97.
We must have met, Errol. I don't recall.
Yes. I'm sure, having seen your picture on your website, truthseeker@roswell.com, that you were probably behind the counter.
I could have been.
When our gang was in there back in 97.
It was a hectic 3-4 days.
Oh, yeah.
We had every media outlet in the world here.
Mm-hmm.
It was fascinating, and it will be again this year, and hopefully this will be the start of another successful festival that will be annually again.
Well, I wish you and the mayor and everybody involved on the committees the greatest success. It sounds like it's going to be a blast, and I wish I could make it down, but I don't think I'm going to be able to. You are on the speaker circuit. Upcoming this weekend, as we record, is the Aztec.
Right. Aztec happened supposedly, allegedly, let me use them words, it happened in March of 1948, which was just about 8 or 10 months after the Roswell incident. Aztec is located up in the northwest corner of New Mexico in the Four Corners area. near Farmington, New Mexico. Small, laid-back little town. And east of there, in Hart Canyon, supposedly, there was a 99-foot diameter craft with as many as 13 bodies crashed. This was not known for many, many years. Wendell Stevens wrote a book, The Aztec Crash. And for years, I didn't put much confidence in the story. And then a fellow named Scott Ramsey from North Carolina started doing some research on it and went to the Air Force archives in Alabama and many other places and started putting information together, interviewing witnesses. And really, it looks like there may be something to this story. The craft was recovered by the military out of Colorado and whisked off just like the Roswell was. The one fascinating thing about Aztec is at the crash site, there is a concrete slab about 3 or 4 feet square, maybe 8-10 inches thick, with rebar reinforcing steel inside, that is off the edge of a dirt road. The dirt road was built sometime in the 40s. We have discovered that. The concrete slab, we thought, was probably a well cap. There's a lot of natural gas and different types of drilling takes place in that area. Checking around with the different companies, that's not true. We found out that it's not a well cap of any kind. It's a slab that was placed there. We took a sample of the concrete, and they had it tested and dated to about 1948. We're thinking that maybe it was a concrete slab placed for the outrigger on a crane, for the crane to get in and lift the craft out and load it up.
Oh, that's interesting.
This is actually physical evidence, which we don't even have with the Roswell case.
Hmm.
So that makes that extremely interesting. And then 10 years ago, they were trying to figure out basically how to capitalize on this, like Roswell has for years. So the public library needed a new building in Aztec. So they decided they would have a festival and try it, and all the money would be donated to the public library. And I'm happy to report that 2 years ago, they cut the ribbon for a brand new public library in Aztec that was basically funded by the UFO symposium they have every year. It's not a carnival atmosphere. It's very little of that. They have good speakers coming in every year. And it's almost like a family thing. I've been there every year for 10 years, either as a speaker or as master of ceremonies, and it's just been an enjoyable symposium for me to and my wife to go up and kind of be with family, really.
Mm-hmm.
This year, the speakers include myself, Travis Walton, who is famous for Fire in the Sky in Arizona, where he was abducted and gone for 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
Travis will be there. Christopher O'Brien will talk about the San Luis Valley, 100 miles north of Aztec, where there was a lot of mutilations and things took place. Mike Forston is coming in. He will be talking about the Phoenix Lights, which is coming back into popularity on its 10th anniversary.
Oh, big time.
Certainly wish they'd bring the Maryland Air National Guard back and drop flares again so we could compare that with what they said they did the first time 10 years ago. I'm very upset that Symington did this, but it's typical of politicians. When he went public with that and brought the guy dressed up as an alien out, that to me just, you know, destroyed the whole thing, and that's typical of the way the media handles something like this. If it's even reported by the media, then they make light of it,
mm-hmm.
and it destroys the article.
Yes.
I had that experience recently with the National Geographic Channel, where Stanton Friedman and I and several others were on a documentary done by the National Geographic about Roswell. I spent 6 hours filming with them, using my vehicle to run around the desert out here all day, and turns out they had an agenda. I was as honest as I could be with the questions they asked me. They called me back, they emailed me for additional information, and when the documentary aired, the very end of it, the conclusion was that Roswell is a myth. And I expected more than that from the National Geographic.
Well, a lot of people expected more than they got from Peter Jennings and
exactly.
His ABC special.
Exactly. That was another show. It was hyped and publicized a lot, and here's going to be the truth, and the first few minutes were, and then it went south. I wrote an editorial on my website on TrueSeekerAtRoswell.com on the bias of the media. I'm really getting tired of doing all this research, being asked to share it for free in order for it to become a biased documentary.
Yet you and many other of the better-known names and faces feel the same way.
Fortunately, everyone that saw the show and commented about it to me said I came across honest and sincere, which was my intent, and always is my intent. But the involvement, you know, being involved with a show like that, the general public just doesn't know. And they will accept. When you see a National Geographic show, you expect it to be truthful and hard-hitting and accurate. And that wasn't the case.
And often isn't. And it's really starting to make me personally very crazy.
Yeah, I want to go somewhere and just shout.
Yes. Well, you have a lot more desert around you than I have backyard. So
I do.
And by the way, you mentioned Scott Ramsey, and Scott sent me a very nice email yesterday about the UFO Updates Archives.
Good.
And happened to mention that he's putting a book together right now, which will be out shortly.
Yes.
And presumably that's about Aztec.
It is, and I'm going to miss him. He's not going to be there this year. He is married to a girl from Farmington who was a radio host up there in the Four Corners area, and they had a raffle at one of the symposiums a few years ago to have dinner with Scott Ramsey, and she won it.
Ah.
And consequently, they got married. And now live in North Carolina. He's an excellent researcher, but they have decided to take off this year. He has been heading it up pretty well for the last few years, him and Suzanne. And he wants to dedicate his time to the book, so they won't be there this year and we'll miss them, but I hope they'll be back again next year.
Oh, I'm sure he will with his book out, too.
I'm going to meet with him in May out in western New Mexico. We're going to see if we can find Ronnie Samora and talk to him. And there's another case out there that we want to look into and see if we can find any witnesses.
I'd like to hear about those investigations.
Okay.
When you get the chance. I know as we get toward July, it's going to get real tricky with the Roswell Festival.
What the mayor has asked me to do, Errol, for the planning committee is to contact websites and radio hosts and promote the festival and talk about my research. And thank you for doing that, by the way.
It's a pleasure. And, in the same way that it's a pleasure to put the poster up for the Roswell Festival on this program's page. So people can go there and jump across to the Roswell Festival.
That's constantly being updated because as we get information confirmed, one of the things we're planning is to have people sign up for a trip out into the desert north of Roswell each night. There'll be a gourmet dinner served. They'll spend the whole night out there stargazing with an 11 and 20-inch telescope. Have the researchers there with them and can discuss stuff with them. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And then a breakfast the next morning and bring them back into town.
And then they fall asleep and miss the rest of the day.
That's right. They'll have to come back. That's the objective.
Sneaky devils. Dennis Balthaser, thank you, sir. It's been good, as always. And a real pleasure to have you back on.
My pleasure, Errol.
We'll talk to you again really soon, I trust.
Okay.
Bye now.
See you.
Well, if this week's program doesn't make you wonder what the hell is going on around our planet, then probably nothing will. But then you'll join us again next week and scratch your head along with all of us. Thank you for being out there. My thanks to Dave Frelott, Stuart Miller, Leslie Kane, Dennis Balthaser, and all of you. Glad you're interested in this subject. There is much, much more to come. Much more to it. These are Strange Days Indeed.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.